Hi, welcome to a Responsum a Day for the 17th day of Iyar. My name is Gideon Rothstein. My partners in this endeavor are the OU, Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hochhauser, who put these shiurim online and make them available to you. And today we're going to have an opportunity to learn from Rabbi Ben Sion Meir Chai Uziel, the first Sephardic chief rabbi of the state of Israel. Prior to that, there was chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. So this is from Shut Mishpatei Uziel, from his volume of Responsa, from the fourth volume, Choshen Mishpat section, Siman Lamedalad, Ransom number 34. It's from the 17th of Iyar of Tafresh Tzadi Bet, which was 1932. So Rav Uziel was, I think, 52 years old. We have previously seen him, I don't remember the exact date, but him respond to an idea of the Tzitzeliezers, of the young Tzitzeliezer, who, you know, the 16 or 17-year-old Tzitzeliezer, who had written him a letter. This is a response to Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, who at the time was living in Warsaw, and it sent him his sefer called Torat HaNazir, and he says, I got your sefer. And as he did to Rav Tzitzeliezer, as he does to lots of people, Rav Uziel writes back with some ideas of his own, which is his way of respecting the person written to him. I read your book. I liked your book. He speaks highly of it. Talks about how it lit up his eyes in its wonderful ways. He hopes he has, and now, Rav Uziel is a much younger man. Rav Uziel is, I think, 26 or 27 at this time. So he's a much younger man. Uziel's a well-established, he's now the chief Sephardic Rebbe of Tel Aviv at this time. And he, you know, writes back to honor him and to respect what he's done and to say, I hope you continue to grow in your Torah. Then he takes up one of the topics in the sefer to register his own ideas. And the question is, if one Jew sells an item or a piece of land to another Jew, but they want to put conditions on that. Now, there are a lot of ways to express a condition. We're not going to talk about all the ways today, but conditions on sales are an important topic in halacha because we'll see the question of the underlying question here. What if I use the words al-minat, on condition that? Right, the word for condition is actually tanai. Tanai is a condition. Right? This sale will not occur unless X happens. So that's a condition of the sale. So the word I think in English usually uses on condition, but it can mean we're going to get to two different possible meanings, whether it's a tanai in the sense that I just said, the sale is sort of in abeyance, or even if we go forward as if there had been a sale, the sale will not complete unless X happens. That's one way to see al-minat. That's a way to see all conditions, but al-minat means on condition that, but on the assumption that X will happen. So on the assumption that is not quite the right word. That could be a tanai condition, like I just said, or it could be what's called a shiura. So a shiura means that this isn't part of the sale at all. We'll see that later in this responsum as well. But an example just off the top of my head would be, let's say I sell you, I'm selling you the contents of this house on al-minat. I don't want to use the word unconditioned because that'll already shape the conversation. Al-minat, that the piano is mine. So what does that al-minat mean? Does it mean it's a condition of the sale of the piano become mine? Or does it mean that everything else is being sold and not this at all? And to both those possibilities are meaningful, understandable possibilities within the words of al-minat. So Rav Kuttner's discussion pointed out that there's a Taz in Yoredeya in Samach Aleph, where the Taz had a problem with the ruling of the Rambam on this question. In Hilchot Nazirut, in the laws of being a Nazir, and the laws of Bikurim, the Rambam seems to have given clear indication that the words al-minat, that those words are a condition and not a shiur, that they set up a condition for something to happen and not a leaving over of something. So the example from Nazirut, I remember right now, we'll get to the example from Bikurim in a second. The example from Nazirut is, let's say a Nazir says, I want to become a Nazir, al-minat, that I'm allowed to drink wine. Now the halacha in the Gemara, the Mishnah in the Gemara already is, it doesn't take effect, it's that the person becomes a Nazir and is prohibited from drinking wine. And that's because of another principle we have in halacha that's called that one is not allowed to be matne al mashekatuv batorah. There are ways to get around things that are said in the Torah that can work and that can be effective. But if a Jew just says, I'm going to do this and the Torah should not be allowed to rule on this issue, it just doesn't work. So if the Nazir says, I want to be a Nazir on the condition that, see, I might have thought, well, he made a condition, the condition doesn't work, and therefore the whole thing doesn't apply. But that's not the way, that's when we say a Tanai, we don't mean that. We a Tanai, I'm sorry, we do mean that. Tonight would be the attempt to say this shouldn't take effect unless this can be true. Yeah, as a matna mashakatova Torah, the rule is that tonight doesn't take effect, is not allowed to get into the way of it, and whatever it was that was going on goes on anyway. So that'd be an Azir example. It'd be a Bikurim example, see as well. But on the other hand, in the laws of Maser, the Rambam, and the Maser we're going to see is if a Levi sells a property to another Jew, and he says, I'm selling to you al minat that the Maser should be mine. And on condition, that's the bad word, but with the assumption that, or with the acknowledgement that all of the tithing of grain that you do from the produce of this field, all the tithing you do of the produce of this field goes to me. So the truth is that would seem to be, if it was a Tanai, that also would seem to be Matna Mashakotova Torah, because the halakha of the Torah says that the Jew can give it to any Levi, and this was trying to make it give it to him, so that becomes a problem. So the Rambam there, however, says it's effective, and that Levi does get the right to all the Maaser from that field. Now the Shach tried to give an answer for this, which the Ravuziel is going to say doesn't work, but part of it will remain as part of our thinking about it. The Shach tried to say, he suggested he did say it. He tried to convince us that it's true. That didn't quite work. Right? That's where that phrasing comes from. Tried to say, I wanted to say. And those phrasings don't mean anything in English, but in halakha language, in Torah talk, what they mean is, I'm saying this now. I'm trying to convince you and convince myself that it's a true way of construing a halakhic discussion. So that's what we mean by the phrasing he wanted to say, he tried to say. What do you mean he tried to say? He said it. The answer is he tried to say it as a convincing and full idea to be included in our lexicon, in our dictionary of Torah ideas, in our mental storehouse of Torah ideas. He tried to put that one in there as well. So he tried to say, his idea was that almanat really means a shiur, meaning almanat means that everything, the sale or the action that's going on now does not include this at all. It's not a tanai, it's not a condition, it's that it never applies to this thing. And that would be the example of the Ben Levi. When a Levi sells a field to a Jew, to an ordinary Jew, who's going to have to give maaser from that field, and he says to him, al-menacha maaser shali, on the assumption with the recognition that the tithing from this field should belong to me, the Rambam paskins that the tithes should need to go to him. That's correct. That's a legal right of his. It's a financial right of his. And the Shach says it's because mishum dekarka bechazkat be'aleha omedet, because the land really is in the possession of its original owner. Now, the way he says it, it's not quite clear. The Vuziel is going to expand that to help our understanding of it. But something about the idea that the lady was the original owner means that when he makes this an almanat, that land, some of that land, part of that land, maybe, you know, a tenth of that land can stay his in the sense of getting the tithe. Now, it's not going to come up again in the tshuva, so I'll say it here, because nobody else says it, but, and I'm not questioning it, I'm just pointing out, this seems to assume that if the Levi could find a way to sort of say, the tenth of the land still belongs to me, he doesn't mean it belongs to me in the sense that I own it, because the other Jew owns it, and the other Jew's going to work it, and he means it's going to belong to me only in the sense that the produce that comes from that should be mine. Okay, but if that's really an ownership thing that remains with him, I might have thought that then the Maaser shouldn't work, because then the Yisrael who's tithing isn't tithing from his own produce. He's just giving to the Levi the tenth of the field that belongs to the Levi anyway. And yet all of these discussions are going to assume that the Yisrael, the purchaser of that field, will still nonetheless fulfill his obligation to give a tenth of that produce to a Levi. To me, that's a very interesting idea. It means that we're saying something more complicated than just the Levi retains ownership rights. He can't retain ownership rights in that sense, because then it wouldn't be the Yisrael's for him to fulfill the obligation of Maaser. We must mean that he's saying, I retain enough ownership rights that this produce, when it comes out, isn't yours in the sense of you get to choose which Levi to give the Maaser to, but in all other senses, it has to belong to the Yisrael, otherwise it shouldn't work. We'll come back to that a little bit, because it will come up as we'll see Uziel's phrasing of it. But when it comes to Matnot Keuna, so Matnot Keuna, this might be the example from Chol Bikurim that I didn't mention before, which is that when a Jew slaughters an animal to eat, and this is a halakha that's not much recognized anymore. It's not much recognized anymore because we have our ritual slaughter is done in big slaughterhouses. That's because so many people are eating so much meat that you don't do it locally anymore. There was a time when you did it locally. I know a man, a very nice man, who was hired to a certain community to come to a community. He was going to be their chazen sheni, meaning they had a cantor, they had a chazen. This man had a fine voice, so he would be there for whenever the chazen couldn't function, and he would do other things. He would be like the shamus in the shul, and he would do shechita, and he would kill animals. So the idea that your local community needed a local shochet, that's a fascinating idea, and it's an old thing that just doesn't really occur anymore. So in the, and that shochet didn't buy the meat himself, didn't buy animals and slaughter them and hope to sell them. When people came to him for meat, or the local butcher came to him for meat, he slaughtered it. So that's lost a bunch of our recognition, lots of recognition of lots of areas of halacha on our part. One of the areas that have lost us is that if an individual Jew owns an animal and slaughters it to eat it, there are parts of that animal that that Jew is required to give to a kohen. That's a halacha that applies today. It applies inside Eretz Yisrael or outside of Eretz Yisrael. The only reason why we don't know about it today, and it doesn't get implemented a lot today, I think, is because there's a question about whether if you have a partnership, then the partnership is required to give those parts of the animal to a kohen, and that's especially true if you have a partnership with a non-Jew. So I think, I haven't checked it out, but I think that the way the slaughterhouses avoid this problem, avoid this issue, is that they enter into a partnership with the non-Jews about these animals, and that frees it, that exempts it from this obligation. That gets into an old, long-standing halakhic question as to when it's perfectly fine to find workarounds against halachot. When the Torah sets up halacha, it has some, we assume, because we believe in Tamei Mitzvot, we believe that there are reasons for Mitzvot that we can access rationally and that are supposed to help enhance our sense of Mitzvot because we have more of a sense of why we're doing them. So the Torah has a reason for it. I would have said the Torah's reason for it would be something like, as we enjoy meat, we should include a kohen, because the kohen represents Hashem, and by giving matanot, by giving gifts from our animals to a kohen, we involve Hashem and the kuna in that process. That's what I would have thought, something like that. But we don't do that anymore, because we don't do that anymore. I once suggested in the show that wouldn't be great if we could have a barbecue where you would buy an animal together, so you'd have to have one person buy, because again, I think that it might even be the partnerships of Jews, we assume, are exempt from Zorah L'chaim and Kevah, from giving these gifts to a kohen, and have a party where you have a shochet come and actually slaughter the animal sort of right there, and then prepare the animal, and then barbecue the animal, but the Zorah L'chaim Kevah, we go to the kohen, and everybody else we would have together, we would all fulfill the mitzvah. People thought I was a little nuts when I suggested that. But in any case, the case that we're talking about here that's relevant to our case is, let's suppose a kohen, for whatever reason, owns an animal and wants to sell the animal. Sells the animal to a fellow Jew, and he says, al minat, those key words, right, on the condition that, with the assumption that, with the recognition that, when you kill this animal, the matanot, the zroa, l'chaim, and keva, the gifts that you're supposed to give to a kohen, which are, I keep saying the words, the zroa is one of the legs of the animal, l'chaim are the cheeks of the animal, keva is one of the stomachs of the animal, you're supposed to give to the kohen, that you'll make sure to give it to me. So there, the shach suggested, maybe there, we don't think of it as a shiur. We're not going to think of it as a shiur. But the question is, why not? So the Veruziel says, I don't understand. If you're clear that Almanat counts as a shear, why doesn't it count as a shear? Why doesn't it count meaning in the field case, we said, it's as if the Levi in some sense held on to part of the field. Well, why not just say the Kohen is holding on to part of the animal, says Rav Uziel. That's his question. And to complicate matters, the Choshen Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat Resh Tet Hey, chapter 209, paragraph 5, says that let's suppose one Jew sells a field, this has nothing to do with Ma'aser now, with tithing, sells a Jew to another Jew, al minat shetitin li kach v'kach b'chol shana. So al minat, condition that, recognition that, assumption that, you will give me a certain amount of money every year, Shulchan Aruch paskins kiyum ha-mekach talui bo, that the sales being in good effect depends on that. And if the buyer does not pay that yearly amount that was agreed upon with an almanat, yitbatel hamekach. the sale is nullified. Now, if the sale is nullified, that means, as Roziel says, that the almanat must have been what's called a tenai. Again, a tenai is a condition. A shear is the sale doesn't apply to this. So if I said, so if we said it's a shear, there's really no way to have almanat mean that for a field of argument. If I tell you almanat that, you give me that much money every year, it would be hard to see it as shear at all because as a leave-over, because I have no thing that I'm leaving over. So that seems to prove to Uziel that we take almanat as a tenai, as a full condition. Now, what I forgot to say at the beginning, but I want to say now here, and thank you for listening so far, and thank you for listening at all, and if you are listening, please do feel free to email, not just free, I would love to hear that there are people actually listening. My email is grothst@gmail.com. Just, you know, pick up an email and send me a thing. Just say, I'm listening. I listen 7 days a week. Or I listen, you know, whenever. 7 days a week is a little hard because you shouldn't listen on Shabbos. But you could listen to the Shabbos on Motzei Shabbos. Anyway, what I should have said was that this seems like a really technical discussion if you're not, you know, deeply involved in the world of halacha. Why do I really care how much is important to the sale? We'll go back. It won't go back. So the answer is that when Jews buy and sell things from each other, it matters to them, and they do it for a reason. And if they later argue about whether a sale meant this or meant that, or whether it should go back or not, that can become an issue. Let's suppose for a second that the field that we're talking about, where the condition was, you know, forget the field. I sell you a multi-billion-dollar business, because I own one, of course. I sell you a multi-billion-dollar business. I say, on condition that you pay me $1 million a year. And I say, almanat. So now, if almanat is a shiur, then I just left it over, then the rest of the sale goes through and I should just be getting $1 million a year. And then if I'm not getting it, I might want to come collect it from you. I might have the right to collect it from you, but the multi-billion-dollar business will stay yours. But if it was a condition of the sale and you don't do it, then I have the right to come back and say, I want the sale nullified, I want my business back. Now you'll say, well, I'll pay you $1 million now, whatever. But if the sale's been nullified, it's been nullified. And then I can get the business back. So you say, why would I want the business back? Let's say my $2 billion business has all of a sudden turned into a $30 billion business. Not because of anything the guys did, but just because it did, I could want it back, and I'm feeling stupid for having sold it. And then you make the stupid mistake of, I apologize, I got the hiccups, I hadn't noticed it. I will try to make sure not to hiccup for you again, unless you deeply want to hear my hiccups. So the point is, if you were stupid enough not to pay off the money that was part of the condition of the sale, I can get my thing back, and you obviously don't want me to get it back. You obviously don't want me to get it back. So that's where you get into arguments about these things. And I use large numbers because it's more obvious and more clear, but there are plenty of times when the numbers are much smaller and yet matter greatly to the people involved. So that's why these situations are important to determine halakhically, because sadly people get disputes about them, and the disputes matter greatly to each of them is the point. So we have to figure out how to do it halakhically. So it seems like almanat as a condition, says Rav Uziel. But then he says, oh, but you might say to me that elsewhere in Choshen Mishpat, Reish Yud Bet, paragraph 2 in chapter 212, the Shulchan Aruch rules that if somebody sells a house on the condition that almanat, that some part of the house, the attic, the upper porch, whatever it is, should still belong to the seller, there we say that, or a place in the courtyard, there we say, yeah, he meant to leave that to himself, and it's not part of the sale to begin with. It sounds like a shiura. So attic is not right, and porch is not right. It's got to be a part of the courtyard, because one of the reasons that Rav Uziel sees that as different is that it's not actually about the house at all. The house is the topic of the sale, and this guy is saying, I want to make sure that part of what's not really part of the house building. So even though it's true that a courtyard is included, or rights to use the courtyard are included in the sale of a house, he's not really taking anything out of the sale, and therefore it's much more of a shiur, a leaving over, than it is of a tenai or a condition. That's one distinction he makes. The other distinction that he makes that's going to be crucial to evaluating many of these cases is that even without that condition, before he made that tenai, that part of the courtyard was his, meaning when it's a sale of something that currently belongs to one party, and that party says, almanat, that this not be included in the sale, meaning that this remain mine, that's not a condition. It's sort of, I'm setting the parameters of the sale. And he points out, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch carefully, you'll see the way the Shulchan Aruch expresses it is, amrinan sheshiyer. We tell ourselves what he means to do is to leave over a place in the field for himself. Kolomar, this is the way Vuziel is interpreting it. Me'ikar hadin, really halachically, almanat usually means a tenai, a condition. But here, since we see what he's saying and what he's talking about, it leads us to assume that he means it in this case, not as a tenai, as a condition, but as a set up, a parameter of the sale. So that line of reasoning leads him to conclude that for the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, almanat is generally a condition, even in the sale of land. So if somebody says almanat that X or Y or Z happens and it doesn't happen, that would nullify the sale. That's the important piece of it. If I say almanat that X happens in the future and it doesn't, the sale is reversible. And that's important because there are times when people regret having done things and they would love an opportunity to reverse it. The other party clearly doesn't want to because they're happy that they got whatever they got. And so almanat will be a way in which a sale might become nullified. The Nesivos HaMishpat, which is an important achron on Choshen Mishpat, had suggested another distinction between cases. He had said that there's something called a tenai de mimela, something that will occur anyway, meaning it's not asking for some new input of information. So, for example, if a person's selling a house in a courtyard and says, I want to leave that piece of it for me and use the words almanat, that's not a new condition. It's something that's already there. This is just his way of expressing the idea we've already seen till now, but it's a slightly different way. And that's going to explain something else for him. The Rambam holds that in the case of selling an animal, where the Kohen sells the animal and tries to say almanat, tries to place either a condition of shiur on the matanot, meaning why wouldn't you say the same thing there? Just say he's leaving over to himself ownership of those matanot, ownership of those parts of the animal. So the Sivas HaMishpat suggested that there it's an animal that's slated for slaughter. Since it's slated for slaughter, this Kohen then is called a matne al mashakatuv b'Torah. He is making condition requiring the other Jew to give him those matanot when the Torah did not say so. That's called a matne al mashakatuv b'Torah. And he's trying to make a condition to force the Torah not to apply to a certain situation. That's not possible. Why isn't the exact same thing true of the Levi selling a field and trying to keep the ma'aserot for himself, trying to keep the tithes for himself? Isn't that the exactly parallel case? So the Sivas HaMishpat suggested that it's not, because the person buying the field, even though he's buying it to plant, could nonetheless plant crops that are not obligated in Maaser. There are examples of things that we can grow that are not obligated in Maaser. Or the Jew who bought it, the purchaser, can find, there are other ways around Maaser. It's called being Maknis Tvuato Derech Gagot. And if one brings all of the grain into one's house, you know, not the usual way, not through the door, that's a discussion in the Gemara. Technically, that grain does not become obligated in Maasro. That would raise a question that I've already raised today, the question of when we're allowed to circumvent stuff, when we're not allowed to circumvent stuff, when it's a good idea to do it, when it's not a good idea to do it. Sorry, I brought this up today in a completely different context. If you were listening carefully and not remember where I brought it up today, that's because I was doing something else before I taped this discussion, and that's where it came up. But it's a general question as to when it's okay, when there are perfectly legally valid ways around halakhot, when's okay to do it. So I'm not sure if someone's going to plant the whole field and bring it in there after goat, that's necessarily the best way to do it. But the Zivos Mishpat point is that therefore, when the Levi makes the condition that should you have tithes, you're going to give them to me, and we can see that as a shiur, it's not being matnah mashakutuv Torah. It's not considered a condition to uproot or violate the Torah, because it doesn't have to happen. But if it's going to happen necessarily, like the animal you're going to slaughter, so then it's matnah mashakutuv Torah. It's not allowed. You could theoretically argue, well, why can't you say that the man might not slaughter it? So that's why he says, he thinks that I'm talking about a case where the man is going to slaughter it. That's what the condition, that's what the terms of the sale, that's what the expectations of the sale are. So if Vuziel doesn't like that, it's for a reason we don't have to get into, because I want to give him a chance to talk for himself, but he doesn't think we really found a good explanation for what the Rambam seems to contradict himself in terms of, and the Gemara seems to contradict itself, because it seems to say each of those is a stam, as a well-accepted halacha, that when it comes to Maaser, we say that the almanat expression works to keep the tithes in his bailiwick, in his rights. Whereas when it comes to the animal, kanuna, there's a debate about it, and we're not sure whether we pass it that way, because we think it's a problem of matnel mashkutu v'torah, of making conditions. So therefore, Ruziel suggests that the Rambam holds al-minat is in general a t'nai, it's a condition of sale. And the determinative proof for the Rambam that was true was the example of a person who says, I am going to be a Nazir, I want to be a Nazir, I accept upon myself nizirut, al-minat, on condition that I have the ability to drink wine, however it's expressed. So there, we say he's a complete Nazir, and Ravina there says that everybody agrees to that halacha, and that it's a case of matnel mashakatu v'torah. You try to create a different nazirut than Torah established. One is not able to do that. And that is the dikduk lashon haGemara, says Rav Uziel. Rav Yeshua ben Levi says, Amar lach, hay al menat, michutz dami. Which says to Rav Uziel, in almost all cases, we treat al menat as a full t'nai, but this al menat is kechutz. And therefore, the Ravina held that the Rav Yishuv ben Levi thought that maybe he should get around it because it's not a matnas l'mitzvah Torah, and that's the way we do it. But it makes clear that he's seeing it as an exceptional case, and that generally al-minat means a t'nai, a condition. So even though that's true for Rav Uziel, and he feels comfortable that he's proven that al-minat is a condition, he does now say, but when there are times in Dinei Mamono, in civil cases, in monetary cases, when Al-Minat works as a shear anyway. So the fundamental answer, in other words, is going to be, it can work either way, you have to check the case. But the general rule, he's saying, is that it's a condition. So if you don't have a proof either way, you assume it's a condition. But there are times when it functions as a shear, when the context proves it. So for example, when a Levi sells a field, so if he says, Al-Minat Shamasa Rishon Shali, right, the condition is, that you give it to me, we understand that to mean it's not that the Jew, he's making a condition on the Jew has to give him a gift, he's making a condition on the ground, on the karka itself, that the ground should not be sold for those purposes of the maser. And since you could theoretically set up, this is the way it was the real reason, since you could set up the sale such that a tenth of the land, and therefore a tenth of the grain that comes out of it, it belongs originally to the Levi, and they're completely separate from each other. He says, She'ein echad yonek michavero. The land is completely separated. In other words, no part of the land is intertwined with the rest of the land. So he made clear that he wants this to stay for him, and that's called a shiur, and that's the way they do it. Now, again, as I said before, the only thing he doesn't notice is that if it really belongs to him, then it's not clear why that giving that to him counts as a master for the rest of the field. So you gotta play with it. Well, you can't. But his point is that there's a way to say that the Levi is keeping it for himself. Any reason to the Rambam, we'll leave that for another time. Or not. The phrase of the Rambam is, Nasa kemisha shiyer mekoma maser. It's like he left over the place of maser for himself. And notice the Rambam says it's like. He doesn't say he actually did it. It's like he did it. So that would be an example of a shiyer. So why not say the same thing about the animal? I'm sorry. So if Yamanat Shatiti Tanai, and if he doesn't give it, it gets rid of the whole Mekach, in general cases. So what about let's go to the Kohen and the animal. Why doesn't it work there? So the reason is that with the Matanot, he can't continue owning part of the animal, because that part of the animal only belongs to him once the animal is slaughtered a Shkita Ru'uya La'achila. Once it's slaughtered, a valid slaughter. I mean, let's say somebody, a Jew buys an animal, intends to slaughter it to eat, and sadly something goes wrong in the shkita, and the animal is now in nevela. So what do you do with that in that situation? You sell it to non-Jews. Does anybody think that you have to give part of that sale, part of the proceeds from that sale, to a kohen? Yeah, obviously you don't. The obligation of Israel Chayim Kevah is to give to a kohen parts of a kosher animal that you're about to eat yourself from the other parts of the animal. Since that's true, says Rav Uziel, there's no sensible way in which you can say the kohen is holding on to parts of the animal for himself, because it's not true. Because those only parts of the animal only become relevant to him should the animal be slaughtered properly and kosherly. And all the parts are joined together anyway. So when he's selling the animal to this guy and he's saying, Al-Manat, that more like a condition, and that's like a matna mashukutu batara. So I promise you that I skipped a lot in this presentation. And we're going to finish actually a little bit early because I skipped so much, a tiny bit early. And I apologize again for the hiccups that came up in the middle of the presentation. If you didn't hear them, then ignore this apology and all the apologies that came before. But Rav Uziel is pointed out by the discussion of Al-Manat with Rav Yitzchak Kuttner at a young age of some of the ways in which sales are or are not constructed by halakha, which ends up having ramifications for people who get involved in buying and selling. And as an example of Choshen Mishpah kinds of things, we have to deal with these issues of human language and human assumptions in language and our assumptions for the meaning of human language in order for people's financial discussions and arrangements to go properly and well. This has been a responsible day for the 17th of Iyar. My name is Gideon Rothstein, Rabbi Jacob Ramitz, David Hochhauser, and the OU help me with these shiurim. You help me by listening and by letting me know that you're listening. Have a great day.